For March 11th, 2024, it's the Overthinking It podcast, episode 819. Spoiler alert, it's filmable. They did it. Welcome to Overthinking It, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. The Overthinkers are your messianic death cult. We are never happier than when we are engaged in a campaign of suicidal terrorism against other bigger websites. I see you, Mr. Beast. I'm coming for you.
Demonetized in the first 5 seconds.
So,
Joke's on you, not monetized.
So yeah, we're doing Avatar 4, The Way of the Sandworm in this podcast, and that's
starring Shia LaHood, right?
Shia LaHood. And we're doing and we're talking about it. We all went back to the theater. Just a quick digression. I'm looking out the window here in the Bleeding Edge. It's still light outside. I divide this podcast into two sort of phases. There are the darkness podcasts and the lightness podcasts. You know, during daylight saving time, it's light outside here. And I don't know. I feel like it lends everything a more ebullient spirit. And so we head into watching Dune Part 2, the second part of the adaptation of the first novel in the Dune, you know, transmedia extravaganza, phantasmagoria, with ebullience and lightness. And in fact, this took us all to the movie theater. Now, quick little digression. I bought a new fancy information watch recently. I bought my last fancy information watch like 6 or 7 years ago, and I wanted some of the new hotness that comes along with it. And one of the things that the new fancy information watch does on your wrist is it gives you warnings if you're in a loud environment, if the environment around you exceeds 80 or 90 decibels. It gives a warning that says, you know, prolonged exposure, 30 minutes of exposure to this level of sound will cause temporary hearing loss. I got that warning 15 minutes into Dune Part 2. As the thumping of the thumpers thumped in my, you know, in my solar plexus there. I was
Matt,
there.
You being a man of wellness, right, and concerned about your health, I'm sure you heeded the warning, right? And you left the theater to protect your fragile ears, right?
Absolutely. Exactly. I will not hear. Sound is the wellness killer. The sound will pass through me, and only I will remain. I really like it. Really made me think about like bringing earplugs to the movie theater next time. But that is I have to. You're
a
musician too.
Do not blunt this amazing sensual experience.
Well, did you have a sensual experience? I mean, your hand deep, you know, where you were elbow deep in the sandworm popcorn bucket, getting all fake buttery.
No,
up on
I didn't
your
have
fingers.
That sensual kind of sensual experience, Matt. Get your mind out of the
what was it like going? What was it gutter. Like going to the movie theater for you?
It was glorious.
Oh, good for you.
Oh my gosh, what an overwhelming, powerful experience. It is as if I was high on some sort of spice or drug or melange, if you will. I was just kind of raving to anybody who would listen to me, like, what an incredible combination of sight and sound and feeling as well, too, right? Because you feel the plom, the thump, deep, deep in your core, and the picture being so big and bright around you really transports you to the to the dunes, if you will. And I will greatly contrast this, of course, with my experience watching Dune Part 1 and being severely underwhelmed. And guess what, guys? I watched it at home on a broken literally on a broken TV. Right? Like the picture the picture was like distorted, like when like there was too much black or white in the image, and you know, like there was no amazing deep sound. And more objectively speaking, right, you know, the first one it just kind of ends, right? There is, of course, big action sequences and things like that, but it's just tons and tons of setup, and is not just like the overwhelming and cathartic experience that Dune 2 is. So yeah, man, I saw it in the theater and it was freaking fantastic.
Pete, you also went to the theater. What how was Jordan's Furniture?
It was great. I did get to see it at, of course, the 4K laser IMAX here in New England at the Jordan's Furniture in Reading. And I wonder, Matt, because I didn't feel like this was an overwhelmingly loud movie, but that might have been because of the utilization of the different sound channels in the surround sound setup in your theater, because it was a tremendously bassy movie for me. The Jordan's Furniture IMAX in Reading has what they call butt kickers, which are speakers under the seats. And so they hit you with subwoofers under the seats. It's like matinee, right? It's like the old school, like creature feature, kind of movies. And like the whole place was shaking, like the chairs were shaking. I have never seen the bass kicked up this high at Jordan's Furniture before. And it was really amazing. Because it had this whole creature feature dimension to it. It was like, you know, well, we're sort of, there's part of this movie that's also Godzilla, which is kind of amazing, right? There's part of this movie that is just hugeness and loudness and like impressiveness, but not just in terms of blowing at your eardrums. I haven't had an experience in a theater like this since Dunkirk, I would say. I think that was the last time I was in a movie theater and I was actually impressed. Because on the podcast then, we talked about how Dunkirk plays a movie theater like a musical instrument. And I don't think that Dune 2 does quite the same thing, but it was a really impressive utilization of the whole sound system in particular. And I was very, very thrilled. And I, too, saw Dune 1 on a mixture of a computer monitor and a phone, like the day before I saw Dune 2. So I will have difficulty telling two of the two movies apart. But at the same time, if I say, well, that scene wasn't very impressive, it was probably in Dune 1 because I probably watched it on my phone.
I watched, I did the same thing. I watched Dune 1. I actually watched it like this week over the two nights before. Over the two nights before going to see Dune in a theater. And I revived my old, I've been in and around the same neighborhood for the last 10 years, ever since I left New England for California. And, though my theater went out of business after COVID, it's now been resurrected by Amazon. So Amazon owns and operates it, Amazon Studios, and they run the front half as a theater. And then they took the smaller theaters and back, like further down the hallway of movie theaters, as they're like Amazon Studios corporate screening rooms. So it's sort of an interesting, little thing that they've set up there. But, we got six or seven like big auditoriums, the big ones up front with all the equipment from the ArcLight now that they've gone out of business. And I revived my ritual of bicycling to the movie theater, right? Like getting myself a nice snack for the evening movies. I would get an adult beverage for the morning movies. I'd get a coffee and, settling myself right into the chair I like and watching it. You might think that 12 is the center of the screen, but the screen is off center in relation to the room. So 10, F10, that's the seat. That's the power seat. The seat you want is F10. I watched it from there, where my chest was thumped by the thumping of the thumpers. I guess rhythmic motion, rhythmic sound is, very important to this film. And yeah, the watching part one on TV was not great. I mean, I had it. I have, unlike y'all, I have no children, so I didn't have to like squeeze it in. I could, dedicate the house to watching Dune for a little while. But what I found was that like it's so Denis Villeneuve is such an artist of like obscurity. It's sand, sand cloud, sandstorm in this one. In Arrival, it was sort of like rain, which is funny because it's sort of a dry miasma versus a wet miasma in Arrival. I guess you could do a typology of the Denis Villeneuve movies into the dry movies and the wet movies. Blade Runner is an interesting case because I think it's both, right? Like there's the blue half of Blade Runner and then the red half of Blade Runner. Oh my gosh, I feel like I've stumbled on a film studies article here. But yeah, the problem with that and the kind of the sort of crepuscular quality of the of a lot of the cinematography is that digital, especially compressed digital projection or exhibition, I should say, because it's not exactly projected on a television. The digital exhibition crushes the blacks. And so you had these like bands, you know, this banding, which is an artifact of the compression. And then the blacks just being crushed all into this like darkness. That's not even really dark because there's light. You can't like douse the light coming out of your television. And so I feel like it was an exhibition medium uniquely unsuited to the artistic strengths of Denis Villeneuve and Dune 1. And so, yeah, Part 2 was a much better, sort of much better visual experience. Because you could still, I don't know, you could still appreciate things like production design, composition, shot selection, things like that in the first, in the first film, even on your phone or whatever. But the actual beauty of the images, as opposed to just kind of the notional beauty that you could imagine, would be there on a better projection system, right? Like the actual beauty of the images was present. Mark, you described it as sort of a sensual movie and not necessarily like a discursive movie. Talk a little bit about like how you responded to it.
Matt, I think you're putting words into my mouth there. I think like I want to start out talking about it as a sensual movie, and then we must quickly move into it in a discursive movie because it's all about discourse.
Well, fair and drink. Yeah, there right? You go.
Right, prophecy and whatnot. False prophecies, storytelling, right? And narrative rejecting. Okay. We'll get there, but just to kind of round it out, right? And very germane to the story as well too, right? What is this movie? The movie's about a lot of things, but it is not about getting high and having a heightened sensory experience, right? The movie is trying to do something along those lines, right? You can imagine a very documentarian style of like cinema verite Dune, which would be very boring to watch. And this is very much not that. That's not a stretch, right? Let's just say that, like, you know, just, and it's not just like, you know, there's aesthetic choices, right? And, you know, Denis Villeneuve wants to make it look pretty and sound amazing and all those good things. But there's an aspect of it which is trying to transport you in a.
I mean, I would even go as far as to say that there's sort of a taxonomy of getting high in this.
Oh, movie. Yes. Okay. Yes.
There's a variety of different ways. So obviously there's a lot you can talk about when you talk about Dune. One of the things that you can talk about when you talk about Dune is its grounding. You might describe Herbert as a metaphysical science fiction poet, similar to the metaphysical poets, in that he, not that he's being metaphysical, but rather that he's being more physical, that he is, he has two main biological inspirations, right, which are ecology and psychedelics, that inform a lot of what's going on in the story. And so a lot of what happens is about how it's experienced by like physical organisms and the minds of people. And so even a lot of the symbolism is rooted or connected to ideas of ecology and psychedelia. And so what are some of the ways that characters get high? High being, you know, a sort of state of, you could say what? A state of intensified or altered consciousness that is, you know, related to some sort of difference from the regular. Yeah. Right. Difference from the normal. Sex. There's sex in the movie. Right. Crying. There's a big deal made out of crying. Like the crying is the most crying that has ever been cried because the water is so precious. Right. And so the tears in Dune are MacGuffins in themselves. They are Maltese Falcons. Right. They are the stuff that dreams are made of. They're intensified. There is definitely people taking drugs and then having visions and going on trips. Right. There's also religious vision, which is not necessarily strictly a drug thing in terms of how it is communicated and understood culturally. But here, of course, it gets kind of combined. This is a 60s story. All these things kind of, you know, swirl around and mesh together. There's war. You know, there's violence. Right. There's the excitement of intense deadly violence and all the adrenaline that's associated with being in mortal peril, right? Or that, you know, sort of seeking out violence.
There's also the high of riding the sandworm.
Exactly, yes. And then there's the high both of like thrill seeking and kind of X Games extreme sports stuff, you know, like Legolas riding his shield down the stairs. Really more Legolas climbing the Olyphant, right? There's riding the sandworm and the intensity of that. There's also the intensity of the weather, you know, and like the and the sort of the climate around you presenting you with super intense stimulus, which in turn, you know, is an altered state because it's the whole world around you, right? Like if you take a drug that makes you feel like you're in a sandstorm, but then you go into an actual sandstorm, you know, like, now I'm not going to say they're equivalent experiences, but like the world around you changing drastically and sort of buffeting you with an altered state of existence is similar in a lot of ways to what's going on here. And so a lot of the states that people enter in are states of being high, you know, high arousal, stimulus.
There's also, remember when Willy Wonka is communing with the spirit of
Matt, call him by his name, please. Call him Shape of Water Guy. That's his name, right? He's the Shape of Water. No, he's not the Shape of Water Guy. I just want to do that just to troll people, but I can't go through with a straight face. He's not Shape of Water Guy.
Yeah, when James and the Giant Peach goes to goes to commune again with the spirit of the Doctor from Star Trek Strange New Worlds, right, whom he has killed in ritual combat before. Yep. He says a good hunter gets as high as he can before the hunt begins, right? Because there is kind of an instrumentality to the state of exaltation, right? That you're talking about. And actually I distinguish between exaltation and ecstasy, right? Like I think those are two related but distinct highs. But he's talking about exaltation. He's talking about being like above, you know, literally above other people. And you do that in order to kind of like map out the terrain, which becomes sort of a metaphor for the clairvoyance, right? For the like the future seeing, and for the like the Doctor Stranging that he does to sort of set his path. But he's yeah, the whole thing is, you know, the whole thing of being high is a literal, I mean, has a literal dimension in the film as well.
Can I ask a question? Do the Harkonnens get high or do they get low?
get low.
I mean, I'll answer my question. I think like when Fade Rautha, who, by the way, is played in an amazing fashion by Austin Butler, just delicious.
Doing a Stellan Skarsgård impression. You know, he's doing doing the voice, my boy, Will Hunting. No one can tell the difference between you and me, but I am one of those people. Like he's doing, I don't know what I'm doing, a pirate, I guess, but like he's doing the pirate voice, just with just wonderful, wonderful dedication, commitment.
Yeah, and he's come so far. He's changed a lot since he was Elvis Presley. I mean, you know, he got quite pale and bald.
Yep. Can I say before the joke drifts too far away that Harkonnen architecture consists entirely of windows and walls?
Yes. No, I was about to say. I was about to say when there it is. When they're watching the thing when they're watching the contest, he does, you know, the Bene Gesserit opposite the Imperial box, right? Are like they wander from the window to the wall, to the captives that drop down and fall.
Yes.
You know, all these crowds call. Oh, kill, Elvis Presley. Oh, kill.
I think the idea with the Harkonnens is that they are so consumptive, and the Baron with the tubes coming out of him all the time, and like hanging out in the mud bath and stuff in the Hershey's chocolate syrup that was used in Blood and Psycho or whatever it is that his bath is made of, that the Harkonnens are supposed to be so swimming in high that they don't enjoy it anymore, right? That it's like they just have so much of it that they are in total excess. Yeah. And the Baron has sort of like, it has sort of ruined him. I think them being addicted, isn't their mentat addicted to spice in the books? That the idea that you could take so much spice that it's bad for you, which this movie does not really communicate all that much because it really hits you with the spice right in the face, like a whole lot. But the idea that sort of Paul is clear-headed is not really a fact that is communicated in this movie very often. He is often swept up in this or in that intense state of feeling just because it's only like 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Yeah, there is a sense, though, that like, I don't know, Dune the novel is a product of a time like 60 mm-hmm. years ago in American mm-hmm. history, right? Like in world history. And it was a time when the full ramifications of like industrial abundance, right, were not totally clear to society on a global scale, right? So like, now it would be like these days, you know, it would be like Doritos with spice, you know, like extra spicy Doritos, you know, that right. Like that. And it would be like, how can we get that, you know, Rockstar energy spice, you know,
the Harkonnens are the humans in WALL-E. Is what you're saying. It's just with like the benefit of more decades of understanding of what people would actually do when given these kinds of resources.
Yeah, but it's really it's like highly moralized, right? Like there it's moralized as a sort of failure of a failure of virtue rather than like, I don't know, being really seen as through an analysis of like systems and power. But they're bad because they look bad, right? Like they either look so corpulent and sort of gross, or else they look. I mean, like Austin Butler looks emaciated, you know, like, and he's done makeup wise to like make him look the hollow and you know, like sort skeleton. Of yeah, skeletal, exactly. Yeah, the black and white helps with that. Helps with that as well. But Pete, you said a word, mentat, which makes me think that you've read these novels. These novels for me were like maybe a notch below. I mean, if Shogun and the Pillars of the Earth were like S tier books that adults have, these were like A tier books that adults have. And like, you know, really? I saw. Yeah, oh, yeah.
I want to push on that. I thought Dune was, I'm surprised you called Dune an adult book, because for me in high school, Dune was a precocious teenage boys book.
Oh,
for obvious reasons.
I hung out all high school with actors who are, I suppose, at the mental level of precocious teenage boys and never progress beyond it, no matter how old they become. So yeah, in the like the small theater with which I was associated for about a decade, there were a number of like longtime company members who were voracious readers, and so like the walls of the offices and the dressing rooms and things like this, believe it or not, were lined with mass market paperback novels, and the Dune series was in them, and like it, I never dived in. It was but it did like it did appeal to me, to the kind of the like the completest instinct in me and to the thing in me that was like drawn to sort of fully imagined like very complex systems. It's interesting that we're talking about this after Shogun, and we talked about the kind of like the overlapping systems of obligation and loyalty that make up the clash of societies in Shogun. And you can see the kind of the bones of that in the film Dune. And Pete, I got to imagine that like in the novels, it's taken to just dimensions unknown.
Oh yeah. I mean, I've only read the first novel, but as we've talked about in other podcasts, I've gone really deep on lore videos on pretty much every super nerd property over the like years since COVID graced our shores. So I'm very familiar with what happens in the later Dune books and the lore, but I've only read the first one. I got it as a present for my 17th birthday and had the sense at the time that I'd already kind of missed out on it. I'd kind of gone the Asimov way in my sci-fi reading, and I had not gone the Dune way. It's sort of a different direction, right? It's kind of how much math do you think people are going to be excited to do in the future? Like, are they going to be really happy about the math, or is the math going to make them really sad? And I think Dune is a story where the math makes you sad. And I read more of the stories where the math makes you happy. Which is, I guess, a weird, that's like nobody who hasn't read these books is going to understand what I'm talking about. But I will say this. We're not going to go on a super deep dive into Dune lore, because I think the movie does a really good job of cutting it. Like just cutting a lot of it out. The first one is more awkward because they show things that they never explain. that they have sort of cut out of the lore that are just for kind of window dressing and to kind of give you a sense of depth for the environment. And the second movie I felt like was much cleaner about what it kept versus what it cut out. But one of the big things that I think is really important about the Dune universe that they allude to in the first movie, and they don't really talk about too much as far as I recall, unless they talked about it while I was in the bathroom twice, is that there's no computers in Dune.
Right.
And this is, I think, part of...
Yeah, there's been like 10,000 years before there was an intergalactic war to no more computers or something.
Not that far, but yes. In like thousands of years in the past, there was a big war to eliminate all of the thinking machines. And there's this idea that I think is characteristic, again, of its time, that along with the idea that psychedelics have superpowers, some of these ideas tend to come around again, some don't. But computers and thinking machines took away what was essentially human, and human beings, in order to more fully realize themselves and who they are, need to exist without computers. There's a religious crusade against computers, because by being bossed around by people who use technology, we are being diminished in our humanness, right? Which is
checks out.
Yeah, exactly. But when you think about what this does from a narrative perspective, it makes everything has gone through humans. They genetically engineer and train humans to be computers, to like be able to do math really fast, to be able to calculate statistics, right? To be able to do complex forecasting, right? So the way that the Dune universe deals with this is that humans diverge into this sort of vast array of mutants. And those who have been altered, the Bene Gesserit are sort of part of this, right? They're sort of meditation to achieve superhuman abilities and all that. But from a storytelling perspective, it serves the purpose of intensifying the human dimensions of thinking and feeling. And in this sense, I would say human in the sense of like undesirably so. Like the things that humans do that are weird or counterintuitive or self-destructive or biased or skewed are all really intensified in the Dune universe, because nobody is just doing anything by the book. They're all doing everything in accordance with their beliefs and who they are as people, right? Which is often, you know, arbitrary. An arbitrary product of chaos, but arrives at you with this like very intense sense of immutability for yourself and your own people, right? And so Dune plays with this a lot. The Harkonnens are like really, really intense. The Harkonnens aren't just like, oh well, you know, you can't run the universe without breaking a few eggs. Right. Like they're not like, this isn't like an I Heart Huckabee situation where there's like Harkonnen is like Jude Law, just sort of blissfully unaware of the sort of philosophical complexities of the universe. The Harkonnens are like, we are greedy and that is the thing that we are, because even our computers are horny and greedy, right? Because they're people like us and we're all people and computers are bad. So there's no accountants among the Harkonnen who aren't like also, you know, all skin and bloodlust under the black sun, right? Even the calculators are like that. And I think it's very good for the storytelling in terms of what it's trying to accomplish. It helps conjure feeling, right?
It takes the kind of the Star Wars desert planet, ice planet, you know, thing mm-hmm. to a new level, right? Like we're the evil family, we're the honor family, we're the good family, yeah. And all the people are evil, and all the people are honor, and all of the people are, you know, like equal, like maybe more or less. More or less like in quantity, but precisely the same in quality, you know?
Yeah.
And not coincidentally, the people from the honorable people are from the planet that just so happens to look like a North European forest.
Yes. Right? yes.
So I guess we'll get into that in a little bit.
And the rapacious people who just conquer and conquer and conquer just happen to be from like, Pink Floyd video. another dimension that I wanted to poke at a little bit while we're talking about this is the idea of I had it right in my head and then we started laughing and the laughter just stripped it all away. Oh, planetary romance. Like watching Dune occasioned me to look up the genre of planetary romance, because I think you hear a lot about the influence of Dune on Star Wars, which I think is just not the way to look at it, right? Like, the idea is that Dune is influenced by things that Star Wars is homaging, that there's this parent genre that has kind of sort of died out of you know, somebody goes to a planet and the planet is kind of the main character, and the planet has like a woman on it that the hero falls in love with who represents the planet, right? And it's this form of science fiction that is like or science fantasy related space opera that like is the sort of origin of like the ice planet and the jungle planet, because they're all supposed to represent these journeys that the hero goes on, and also these sort of sexual escapades that they go on, where like the planet is imagined into being as having these dimensions and aspects, and that there are many, many, many books that just deal with these individual planets, and that Dune is kind of I don't want to say a send up, but definitely it's deconstructive of a lot of what's going on there. And then Star Wars is like an homage to it. And so Dune feels like a critique of Star Wars, even though it came out 12 years earlier, right? Because it's critiquing the things that Star Wars is a retro appeal to. And then also, you know, you go back to the sand and the desert planet, you're talking about Princess of Mars and John Carter and all that nonsense, right? Like,
oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what a good example of that, of the genre is.
William S. Burroughs, right? Is that who it is? It's John Carter, big time. Okay, Carter is, like, the ur-influence for all this
stuff. We must have talked about this before, right? But this is the first time this idea is really clocking with me, so I'm absolutely here for it. And I love that you just kind of, you know, just appropriately kind of put Star Wars and Dune in the star chart.
The Star Market. I put them in the Star Market. It was a Shaw's, but now it's a Star Market. No, it's a Stop and Shop now.
Since we started to talk about how, right, Dune is a deconstruction of all this and Star Wars is an homage of all this, and we started to, can we just do the whole, like, Messiah business and White Savior stuff
now? Can we do
now?
The Messiah business? Is that... Yeah. you want to wash my feet, Mark? What's going on? What are you talking about?
No, not that at all, no feet. No, I want to save you from your oppressors and the way to hold the world.
Wash your feet? What are you, a trans activist in a Super Bowl commercial? Come on, Pete.
Okay. So here's one idea of what the deal is, right? One of the things that Frank Herbert is doing in this movie, yes. One of the things that he did in this book that's being picked up and being interpreted in this movie. And this also relates back to Shogun, right? Which is, I got a message that I was pronouncing Shogun wrong, which of course I was.
Who sent you that message, Pete? I want to shame that person.
No, person will receive only honor by remaining nameless.
Well, that's racist. What do you like?
They're helping me. They know that I want to do things well. Anything worth doing is worth doing well. But so part of the idea here, right, is that you have these old school, I mean, we're talking like 1910s here, right? Like the soldier goes to the other planet. John Carter, he's a sort of the same writer as Tarzan, right? So it's like a dude in a different environment, being a dude, right? And we are decades away from the theory of the subaltern and any sort of modern notion of post-colonialism, right? Like, we are far, far away from all that stuff. But the idea that like, that the society that you go to is going to potentially have this preconceived idea of having a savior, and then like you show up and oh man, like you're going to be that savior, you the hero, right, is going to be the savior that the civilization was looking for this whole time. This is a common thread, I think,
and it's going to be awesome
stories, and it'll be awesome and everybody's going to be happy about it, right?
And you'll get the girl, you'll kill all the enemies, yeah. You'll save the people, it's going to be great.
Yeah, and so like with Star Wars, you know, he takes this and he kind of takes it out of the cultural standpoint, where it's not like there's a group of people who thinks that Luke Skywalker is going to be the savior, right? There's this like religious idea that's also a philosophical idea, and it kind of gets taken away from the idea that he's going to be like, you know, worshipped by anybody other than Muppets, right? But at the same time, there's this idea that he could save something. Right. Like and he could be the sort of savior of the universe, but in this sort of different sort of non-denominational way. Right. Like and that's sort of one way that's engaged with. But the thing that Frank Herbert does is like, well, OK, so we have these martial histories of colonialism. We have these histories of like the politics of various sorts of, you know, adventurous colonial and imperial enterprises, where these like men go out into the wilderness and they find things. And the one thing that we always forget or forget to mention, which, and this is something that Shogun does mention, is that this guy is not the first one to go. The guy, the story of the, you know, the conqueror who goes and subdues and becomes the champion of the civilization and kind of like shapes it all. That guy was never the first guy there. The first people who were there were the missionaries, and the missionaries go first. And this is one of the things that Frank Herbert is saying, like the missionaries went ahead of all these people, and the missionaries did a lot of work and affected the civilization a lot before any of these people show up. So if you show up in this place and they have these like ideas about messianic belief systems, and they have these ideas about like a second coming and a kind of apocalypse, like they didn't just like come up with them. Right. Like somebody went there, you know, before you. And when you look at the time, I mean, we have a real habit in, I think, in at least American society of really compressing the timeline of the of like the colonial era, which is like hundreds and hundreds of years. Right. Like that all this stuff is taking place. And so but we tend to like compress it down to like, you know, there's Thanksgiving and then there's like Wounded Knee. And that's pretty much everything that happened. Right. but no, like one of the things that Frank Herbert is saying is that like this group of people went out to religiously engineer this planet before the Atreides got there for their own ends. And so then he shows up there and they have all these particular sorts of beliefs, but the beliefs are there for a reason. They're instrumental to, and to, this other group has sort of set them up, which is not the way that it would work in something like John Carter, where John Carter kind of shows up and we've never seen someone like you before, right? Like, oh my goodness, right? And like, oh man, you're a Confederate soldier. How noble, how brave you are, a Confederate soldier. Like, okay, come on, Disney, make that into a movie. Good luck. It'll probably lose $100 million, if not two. Oh, wait, it did. But yeah, you hear what I'm saying? Like, I think part of what Frank Herbert is doing is he's showing the strings. Right. He's trying to show more moving parts in the way this whole thing works than a lot of the other stories of this ilk. And I think one of the big things that Dune deals with, and I think I mentioned this in the back channel too, is like, when does the story begin and when does the story end? Mm. And how is your perspective on what is happening being manipulated by where you start the story and where you end the story? If you just follow Paul, it's a very straightforward sort of story, but there's all this other stuff that happened before Paul and around Paul and after Paul, and then I mean after and after and after and after for thousands of years in the Dune sequels, which of course you can watch all sorts of lore videos about on YouTube if you have nothing better to do with your life. We already podcasted about that.
But no, yeah, I get you're making a joke about it, but I see the attraction of like really going deep in the Dune lore. That sounds like fun to me.
It's fascinating. The Dune lore is pretty fascinating. I could go and read those other books. I could have just done that, but I didn't. I read, and I think a lot of people only read the first book because the first book is the adventure book. And then the other books are the sort of extended world building, long historical question. Things start getting really unfamiliar and weird, at least according to what I've seen.
Yeah, exactly. There's a, like, you know, the equivalent, the Ender's Game equivalent is what, like Xenocide or something like right? Yeah. Like a later novel that's very, you know, I don't know.
Ender's Game is a good comparison, I think, based on like the first book is its own story, but then it's part of this longer story. And some people will say the rest of the story is better or deeper or whatever. But anyway, sorry, go ahead.
And also becomes like a franchise, just takes over the author's output entirely, right? And like becomes the thing that their life is about in the whole, you know. But Pete, is it it might have been some time since you've read the books. Some of the anti-extremism discourse was to me very, very contemporary, right? Like the idea where it's explicitly said, right, that, you know, religious belief is a tool used by powerful elites to control the lives of the downtrodden, right? Like that strikes me as you're talking about, like, this was written before a contemporary theory of post-colonialism, before a contemporary theory of the subaltern, right? Like that this is the kind of the adaptation, this is the adaptation's concerns being kind of inscribed on the, right, on the, like, the palimpsest of Dune, of whatever is being done in the adaptation here.
I think the big change in the adaptation is just how much people care about the Fremen. And like the adaptation, the movie, this movie cares a lot more about the Fremen. And like, in particular, the Paul or the Atreides in general, like not just Paul, but the Atreides faction in general is framed as much more sympathetic to the Fremen than they are in the books. And I think that also the Fremen jihad, and we were talking about this in the back channel too, members of our Overthinking It think tank who have read the books more recently and read more of them. The attitude toward the jihad that happens, of course, in the movie, they don't call it jihad. They call it holy war. But the idea that the Fremen are going to go forth and sort of Atreides, Paul's faction is going to go forth and kind of purge the galaxy of non-believers, that this is like positioned as kind of a really bad thing that Paul has kind of deliberately made happen. I think that it's more treated as like, well, this happened, right? Like this, like sort of history is kind of marching on. I don't think you really get
Just clarify, Pete, the book is like, well, this happened.
Yeah, or like Paul is like just that. Sort of like, I can't really stop this. Like the Fremen are the Fremen and they're going to do what they're going to do. You know, like I've sort of set this into emotion and now there's going to be a jihad and like it's just going to happen. You know, like as opposed
to
this one.
Be clear, right, in the movie, Paul at first is like, no, I can't do the holy war. Can't do the holy war. And then he's like, y'all, we're doing holy war.
Yeah.
That was my read of it, at least on the surface.
I think that it reflects also a contemporary sense of how you perceive changing kind of group attitudes, because in the 60s there would be no way of knowing what like the mass of Fremen were thinking at any given time, right? If the Fremen were real people, you know, there's no like, oh man, you know, we're sort of watching and listening to what everybody thinks and we're getting the sense of the interrelation of ideas and people are kind of making these sorts of personal arguments. You know, if this is all being done through newspapers or news anchor reports, right, you're not familiar with this idea that you maybe even could know what all the Fremen are doing. The Fremen are scattered all over the planet in these different cells. You don't meet a lot of them in the story, right? Like they convene at certain times, but like you don't know what they're doing. You don't know what they're up to, right? So like the idea that you are responsible for what they do, it doesn't really feel as urgent or as true as it does, I think, in a contemporary reading where people really do have this sort of parasocial relationship with other people's political conflicts, right? Where it's like you really feel invested in it, right? Like this war, like Paul feels like it's very real to him. Is it real to him because he's gone and talked to all of them? He means he's been participating in it, but like he's only really had a couple of big speeches with all these people. He can't really speak for all of them. He doesn't really. He's not, you know, he's just one person. But he's also, I don't know, it's tricky, right? It's like, it's what is the appropriate attitude that Paul Atreides should have towards this holy war that's being fought in his name? And I think it is ultimately tragic, but I think the adaptation does a better job of making I would describe it, this phenomenon, when I was talking about this in improv direction, I would describe it as the teeth of the gears biting. Which I really would refer to when you're paying very close and focused care to the levels of emotional causality in your story, right? That like this event happens, therefore this event happens, therefore this event happens. How does each event make each group of people or person feel, and how does it motivate what they do? And I think that there are stories where events can just sort of follow. And part of it is the storytelling style. What are you taking time to talk about? What are you not taking time to talk about? Maybe you don't even really see what everybody is thinking and feeling. And then there are stories where you really go through and you're supposed to sort of, you get that opportunity, you get that chance to connect on an intellectual and personal level with people as these kind of decisions are passing through. And I think, again, it's been a long time since I read the book, but I think there's more of that in this movie than there is in the book, specifically around the idea of mobilizing the Fremen as a religious war. That just the sort of each step that it takes feels like it has more weight and connection to the steps that happened before and the steps that happened after. Whereas this is still mid-20th century science fiction, and the idea that like organizations can kind of set these big plans that just sort of go, You know, like, okay, there's, you know, the foundation,
sure.
Right?
The Rand Corporation.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Like, the Rand Corporation, right? Like, you know, the Yalta Conference, right? Like, people get together and they make a plan, and then the whole world follows the plan and it just goes. And that's just how life works in the mid 20th century, because you're not like aware of the micro history of it. You're just one very, very small piece in a great big machine that doesn't have cameras everywhere. And so you don't necessarily see how the sausage is made all the time, although you eat a lot of sausage. I don't know. I'm ranting a little bit. What did you think about it, Mark, about the level of like sensitivity? Because I'm not saying that the ultimate message is different, but I think it's performed differently. I think Paul's characterization is different. I think Timothy Chalamet brings a greater sense of urgency and sort of angst to the Paul character than I've seen before, other than just through yelling, which is often the way that it's communicated in performance, right? Like,
No, I was really trying to clock Timothy Chalamet, because he's really not a, there's something sort of feminine. There's something sort of delicate about him. He's physically small. His
bird bones. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. His cheekbones are like extremely right. Like, and yeah. So I was kind of like, how is he going to leading man? And especially how is he going to leading man in a franchise that also has Jason Momoa in it, where, yeah. You know, against whom no mortal can stand. Right. Like, yeah. So I was watching, and the way he does it is that he leans in and talk slow and raspy, right? And that's his, yeah. That's the kind of the acting move that he does, rather than the, why are you, you know, like the kind of ranting and raving that a kind of more physically imposing actor could do. And he does it a lot with Zendaya, where it's, you know, where he's like just, he's conveying that sense of sort of internal struggle. It's almost like he almost like compresses it until it lives entirely within his throat. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's where that, I was trying to clock that aspect of the emotional tone. And that's where it came for me, because I'll tell you what the cashier at the Trader Joe's said to me this morning when I said on our weekly shopping trip that I was going to go see Dune Part 2 today, he said, "I don't like Timothy Chalamet, but I did enjoy Dune."
Yeah, well, you're not supposed to like him. That's
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So let me jump in here.
He started the person, Timothy Chalamet. You know.
No. He specifically, you're not supposed to like him personally. It's part of his whole Chanel thing. I don't actually know what. I don't know what brands he does. We're supposed to find him, you know, intolerably young. And intolerably
we are,
pretty.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, we are specifically. And then other people who think we're really old are supposed to recognize that and respect him more for it.
Yeah, but this was a young person. This was a young who was saying this to me.
Gotcha.
All right, let me try to get in here. Just for my reference, right, you know, I did read Dune as a precocious teenager. And not surprisingly related with it, because it's about a genius teenager who rises to great prominence.
Yes,
that was my main recollection of it. And the ambivalence around that rise to prominence. I don't remember a lot of it, but that's what really struck me about the movie, and how it's like working on telling this story in so many different ways and allowing you to experience all of the takeaways of Paul's Holy War at the same time, which is like on the sensory level, you are in awe of it. It is an amazing spectacle, and you are really rooting for him to just freaking kill them all and have revenge and stick Austin Butler with the knife and all that great stuff, right? At a personal, interpersonal level, right, you feel the strain that this has put between him and Chani, Zendaya's character. Mm-hmm. And that is heart-wrenching. And then, as well, at the intellectual level, you are just, your head then starts, so earlier your heart is spinning, and now your head is spinning, right? This is what Bigot said before, right? This is not just a sensual movie. This is very highly a discursive movie. You are just, like, left grappling with the extreme complexity of what you just saw, right? Which is that, like, okay, so this is all spawned by a sprawling multi-generational conspiracy theory, that, you know, ostensibly has these other aims, and you are meant to feel, then you're also then meant to feel bad that you felt good about the Holy War. And this is all really complicated, but wasn't this such a fun ride? But oh, this was also really complicated. That's kind of like my my very compressed way of reading into all that. I guess that was a journey from underthinking it to overthinking it for me.
Yeah, I think maybe one of the key things about Dune is it doesn't. It's tempting, but ultimately unsatisfying to paint Dune with a broad brush.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, this is not very simply an anti-colonialism. It is, first of all, like, it is not a white savior movie, right?
This is not a great white savior.
Okay. But to be clear, right, Avatar is pretty straightforward a white savior movie.
No,
right?
when Twink Jake Sully makes Zahelu with the sandworm flying high in the air, that part was a white savior movie, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, he doesn't just ride a worm. He rides the biggest worm they've ever seen.
That's all in service of the broader problematization of the white narrative business. To be fair, right?
Fair point.
There's a bit of Walter Whiting that's happening. There's a bit of Tony.
Yes. Soprano okay. There you go. Yeah.
Wherein, like, oh well, are you watching this movie with a pure heart? If you watch this movie and you weigh your heart against a feather on the scale of Anubis, are you going to be get the good message or the bad message from this movie? Sorry, I'm being too glib. But the idea I think is that that a lot of Dune presents these really intense tableaus and moments and kind of moments in its conflicts and kind of moments, I guess you could say moments of recognition, moments of reversal that are, it takes a while to get to them in the book, right? The book is very slow and has a lot of discussion. And then it has these sort of big, justice events, right? These big, like, you're making a big social gesture with this big thing that's happening, even if it's something like the scene with I want to call it the hunter killer, but the hunter seeker, where it's like, don't sit with your back to the door. And then the hunter seeker comes in. I mean, it's like Kabuki, the way that that is told. Where, he sort of stands there and it shows up and then he can't move and it comes closer. I mean, he doesn't have a fan that's like sort of going in a circle, but he might as well, right? Like in the sense of like the event, we are seeing the event that is happening. And a big part of, I think, the project of this movie. So I think when people say that Dune is unfilmable, reflecting upon these movies that we just saw, which are very obviously Dune filmed, right? Like it's... Spoiler alert, it's filmable. They did it, right? Like they did it. But the old ones, part of what makes it so hard is that you're trying to sort of tell the whole story. It's like, how do I tell the whole story of Dune? And it's like, well, you don't. You show the moments of Dune. You get to the events of Dune, and Dune is driven by these events. Like we see, instead of seeing, like the discussion of the whole guerrilla campaign and all the multiple battles and like lines on a map or being told how it's going, we get that one really intense scene of taking out the big mechanized thing. Right. And then we get like one other one. But like so much is told in just that one big scene. I think that's very Dune-ish. That so much is being told in these big scenes with these big things that are happening to big objects and big people and big monsters and big vehicles. It's practically Bob the Builder, right? It's like there's a giant crane and a big bunch of I've watched a lot of toddler television and like it feels like the kind of thing that toddler television thrives on, which is just like, let's just make everything a little bit bigger, a little bit simpler, but also like arrive at the complexity through emergence.
And also just really focused on construction equipment.
Yeah, exactly. It's lots of construction equipment and animals. It's all construction equipment and animals. Some of the animals are prehistoric. Some of them aren't real.
And intense psychodrama between mother and son and daughter as well, too.
That's true. That's true. You have to go to Peppa Pig for that. It's really where it's like, we hate you, father. I hate you too. Why am I watching this terrible pig show? Like, you have to. We are the Harkonnens. But that's the spoiler alert. Is Papa Pig is Baron Harkonnen, and Peppa Pig is that the
Anya Taylor-Joy.
Exactly. Did you know that was part of House Harkonnen, Papa? And that's not how she talks. Whatever. George tastes blood everywhere he goes. George Pig. but yeah, I did at one point refer to Tommy Boy. What are some great Harkonnens of Apologia? Tommy Boy is great Harkin in Appalachia. There's some other good.
Sure. Any, I mean, yeah, for, you know, see the works of Farley, comma, Chris and Candy, comma, John, you know, quote vide. Yeah. There is a whole, I mean, I feel like Santa Claus is Harkin in Appalachia, you know?
Yeah. Big appetites and big resources, right? And like big machines that fly around for in impossible ways, doing impossible things due to like some sort of magical dust or something.
What's his like supervillain name? Kingpin. Is Kingpin Harkonnen Apologia, or is he Harkonnen Criticism? You know?
Oh yeah, that's a good point. Like Kingpin, the Vincent D'Onofrio Kingpin.
Yeah,
like,
that's the one that I think, because that's the one I've been watching Echo while I answer emails at work. You know, recently on my on my little screen over to the side, and so yeah, I've been just watching him, and he's another one who really rasps out the lines. You know, though he is extraordinarily big and imposing in that he's in fact the anti-Chalamet, you know, D'Onofrio, on the D'Onofrio Chalamet continuum, right? We all fall somewhere on there.
Most of us closer to D'Onofrio than we'd like to think or admit.
The older we get, for sure. Yeah.
I was thinking the shots where he's riding the sandworm that are shot from like a low angle from the body of the sandworm, I think were really brilliant. I think the placement of the camera is a huge part of the storytelling in this movie, and I'm so impressed by it. Even if it's the stabbing in the duel where they just keep that knife just out of frame so you can't see it, and then you see it. The reversal that happens is in what the camera is looking at, you know, and like the riding. There's a lot of shots where Timothée Chalamet is shot from a low angle, and you sort of see how long his body is, like how tall he is, which I don't know if he's actually tall or not. You can never tell. But like he looks like this imposing figure, right? Almost alien. I mean, he is alien. I mean, in Dune, the aliens are people. That's kind of another big part of how the whole thing is, right? Like the aliens are people and the people are aliens. The other is everyone. Everyone is the other, right? Like nobody gets along. Nobody feels at home. All of the people who feel familiar are murdered at the beginning of the story and never come back. And the ones that stick around are like perverted past all reasonableness or recognition.
Five foot ten. So slightly above average, but not. Yeah, but you know, would still get like a lot of women on Tinder would just reject him out of hand for not being
and
over
for those 6 feet. Shiny pants. You know, did you see those shiny pants?
I thought it was good. I liked the sandworm riding scene. I thought there are a lot of sort of flying scenes in movies, right? Like, and in Avatar, there was one, for example, and a lot of them leave you cold. But I thought this one really captured a sense of exaltation, right? Like a sense of the kind of the exuberance of it, equaled in my mind by the flying scene in Harry Potter 3 in the, you know, the one that's about time and aging, that's like, another one that's really exciting. And yeah, I agree. Like I was watching that last duel also with some interest, right? Like in an interview, Jackie Chan once said that, like, you know, if the camera is moving, right? Like if the camera is basically not stationary and just kind of like side, you know, on like, a parallel, perpendicular axis to the actors, while they fight, the actors don't know how to fight and they're covering it with like camera moves that give you the sense of momentum or kinesis, but that don't actually deliver it in terms of the performances. And this was very confounding to that sort of simple analysis, because they didn't show, like, the camera wasn't moving a lot, but a lot of the action of the stuff was framed out. Like I noticed also that, like, sometimes it was like from the waist up, and the hands or the knives or something like that were just framed out, you know. Yeah. And it was clearly them doing it, you know. It was not it was not shot in a way that they could sub in stunt performers, right? Like it was clearly the two guys doing it, and I thought they did all right, you know, but it was shot in a way that was not to the that it had a different artistic project than the Jackie Chan artistic project, you know. And that was very interesting and good, you know. You podcasted well, Fenzel.
Oh, well, thank you very much. May your mic chip and shatter. Is that a compliment? It's not a compliment. I don't know. I don't get the respect rituals that are going
right, like
on.
Like that's yeah. May your blade chip and chatter. Why is that? That's not a respect ritual. It's like, I hope your equipment falls apart.
Yeah, I hope you lose. I want to win and I hope you lose. This is something that I wanted to raise with you guys, which is, it is such a, like, what is good in Dune? You know, is part of the question.
To crush your enemies, see them driven before you and hear the lamentations. Oh, sorry. That was,
thank you, Baron.
That's what's best in life, right?
Yeah. But like, okay, other than the fact that the good guys are clearly the sandworms, right? And like the sandworms are the most sympathetic characters. And the only like unambiguously good characters in the whole story are the sandworms and the cool one. That's why they're the only ones invited to Beetlejuice. But so there's this notion in Dune. So part of why I think Dune has this part of the problem, difficult. I won't say problematic because it's a lazy word. Part of the fraught relationship that Dune has with planetary romance and kind of old white man's burden-y style sci-fi fiction is that the characters are not doing good things to people. Right. Like that. Like there's not necessarily a big problem at the end that's solved. There's not necessarily like a bad guy who, I mean, the Baron is sort of dealt with. But like, you know, it's not like we're so glad that this thing happened. Like, so what is the good thing that is happening? Because it's not the Atreides coming to Arrakis. That's not the good thing that happens. One of the good things that happens is that people get better at stuff. And I wanted to see what you guys thought about this. This idea of like learning and training and improving yourself, is Dune sort of like a productivity podcast porno where it's like, you know, if you take 10,000 hours to learn to ride Shai Hulud, then, you know, you too can become an outlier.
And if you take these supplements.
Yes, exactly. And if you take these supplements.
I read the 4-hour sandworm, and so I'm ready to ride.
The key is to get someone else to ride the sandworm and move to Costa Rica and just eat. Don't eat any legumes. but there's this intensity, and I got to credit Jordan for chatting with me about this, because one of the things that always strikes me about Dune is just the freaking name. Dune, it is a planet covered in sand. The world is just a bunch of sand. Everything is super bleak and like everybody is going to get killed and there's no respite. There is no balm in Gilead. This is about a world that is a bunch of sand and people are going to treat it that way, right? Like it is a hill of beans in this crazy world and there's going to be a war over it, right? It's almost like 50 Cent blood on the sand, right? Like the sand only exists to be bled on probably by most of G-Unit, right? Right, as well as its enemies,
But what are the? I'm sorry, I don't want to. What are the virtues that are unquestionably virtues? Right?
Yeah.
Is what you're saying?
Because if the world is this very, very bleak place, but the psychologists of the characters aren't fatalistic. The characters get very driven and they get very ambitious and they want to accomplish things and they want to better themselves and become things.
Well, the world is a bleak place in two ways. One is that it's, you know, physically bleak, right? Like it's inhospitable to life. And the other thing is that everyone is trying to blow you up, right? Like that's the other thing. It's like politically bleak. And so I think they have to be tackled as separate issues, right? Like
that. And I would add to the bleakness as well that everyone is also robbed of their own agency, right? They're just pawns in the Bene Gesserit's game.
Exactly. Like it's all a con, you know? It's like, but anyway, sorry, go on.
But I think that like in the first, that like there's a sense of sort of consonance with your environment that is, you know, part of that is a good. Right.
Okay.
Like a sense of learning to sandwalk, or right when he tries to mansplain sandwalking to Zendaya, right? Like that, like, or, you know, knowing how to do it, or like, you don't know the ways of the desert. You don't know our ways, you know, that there is a sense that there is a, not symbiotic, what consonant is the best I can do, right?
Yeah.
Relationship between the people and the environment in which they live. And that's, you know, that's sort of in itself, that's a good, right? Like, the people get involved in conflicts with other people, and that's a whole other thing. But I think that, like, kind of adapting, you know, adapting yourself, to a you know, a sort of reality based ecology of behavior, is, that's a good, right?
Okay.
Conserving water, very specifically.
I was struck watching this movie by how technologically impressive the Fremen are, which is, I think, a bit of a gap in the story and also in, like, tellings of the story, because the Fremen are never shown to have any sort of resources that would allow them to, like, manufacture any of these things.
Yeah, exactly. Right. They don't have a big excavator. You know, they don't have any of the fun power tools that make toddlers happy. So how did they like really like plane the walls on their, you know, their big chambers with like perfectly plumb orthogonal walls, right? Like that's, I'm not sure. Was it done by hand, by chisel, like over the millennia?
What is their supply chain for the thumpers? Right.
Yeah.
Where are they sourcing the fine ball bearings for the up and down motion?
Yeah,
sure.
Especially
with
computers, you know, how do they even do that? Do they not use any water in their manufacturing processes? How do they make the plastic?
There's an inconsistent relationship to steampunk. Yeah, in the production design of some of the Fremen stuff. Like the wind farming, the wind moisture farming, you know, is a lot more steampunk than the thumper is, or than some of the binocular stuff is. Though the binoculars could have been looted, right? Easily enough.
Yeah. Because one of the unfortunate, I don't want to call it a truth, but one of the unfortunate circumstances of a lot of colonialism is this mistaken belief that different groups of people have intrinsic affinities to like different terrains and different ways of living in like a very, very profound and major way. Like, oh, like we want to go grow sugarcane somewhere. We have to use African slaves because they're the only ones who have the temperament and ability to do it because of their blood, right? Like, and it's like, no, if someone whipped you, you would also harvest sugarcane, right? Like you know, it's there. It's not that, that's not what's doing it. Like there is yellow fever and that's a situation. But like, but they really did believe that, you know, in the absence of other scientific evidence, that like the different races of people had these different almost like abilities. And I think that's one of the things that becomes difficult when you start talking about fantasy literature with racial essentialism. And then in Dune, you have this situation where the Fremen don't really have like magical powers. They're not like, they don't have like genetic powers, but they have this technology that is better, right? And it's sort of like, okay, you know, where does the technology come from? And not that I would demand more lore, but it's sort of like, are we really saying that they've adapted their society to this? Have we really totally separated ourselves from the idea that these are like the desert people who have like the desert abilities? And I guess we have, because it's like, oh, it's a still suit. It's really impressive. You know, they take the spice, which gives them a lot of stuff, and anybody could take the spice, I guess. But you're picking up what I'm putting down, right? Where it's like the abilities that the Fremen have to overcome their environment are a moral good in the story, and Paul adopting them is a moral good in the story. And I love how you said that it's ecological, because I think it's not meant to be anthropological as much as not meant to be. It functions. It makes more sense as an ecological argument than as an anthropological argument. If the idea that it is good for Paul to live in accordance with the resource availability and kind of proper kind of survival mechanisms for living in the desert, if that's good, then that's because it's a desert, right? It's not like it's good for Paul to conform to what the Fremen are doing because they're the desert people, because, you know, he's not a desert person and they're desert people. And then we get into this really tricky and kind of awkward and difficult relationship of like human beings with like the kinds of labor that they've been forced into over the years in their different scenarios and situations, or that they just happened into by luck. And it's like, well, yeah, but you know, luck is destiny, best of all possible worlds, right? It can't have happened any other way than that it did, I guess. I don't know how you feel about that.
I'm gonna try to answer your question in terms of like, you know, who or what is good in Dune, and I'm going to answer that again. I mentioned Chani before, so let's talk about Chani one last time as we start to wrap this up here. Right. So Tani, you know, has all the good virtuous behaviors we described before in terms of, you know, being a Fremen and, you know, being in concert with the desert environment. And that extends to the other thing that she does, which is virtuous, which is ultimately not go along with the power narrative and try to control things which should not be controlled. Right.
Right.
Like, you know, like to be serious, like being in concert with the desert means not trying to control it, not trying to exploit it the way that everyone else is trying to just, like, you know, dig up all the spice and just everything else be damned. Right. Tani is not going along with the Holy War because she sees it like, and she just keeps, you know, criticizing Paul for wanting power. Very specifically, and her walking away, her riding that sandworm off into the desert is, you know, rejecting just like the awesome thrill ride that everyone else is going on. It's like, hey, space opera! Like, you know, we fought this awesome war, let's get on the spaceships.
They got Christopher Walken in there. Does she know? Does she know that there's Florence Pugh with the crazy metal hat on? Does she know? Yeah, she was in there, buddy. She left. She didn't think it was cool enough. I don't get it.
So that's it, right? So, and again, like, this the whole metatextual thing in this movie, which I found just so amazing and fascinating, right? Which is like, wow, wasn't this awesome? No, actually, it wasn't. But it was awesome.
Yeah. But it wasn't. Oh, this whole thing was a mess. Here I am with my ethno-nationalist movement, and this charismatic leader came along and used it for his own ends. Who could have predicted that sort of thing would have happened? But no, yes, it's like, because I don't think that's in the book either. I don't think that happens. I believe you're right.
Yeah, from the research that I did prepare.
Yeah, they definitely had a Zendaya problem with these two movies where they're like, how do we make her in the movies? Because she doesn't show up in the whole first part of them. So she sort of like shows up here and there in the first movie as like a flash forward. Right?
I mean, the first movie had the problem of that it was all about the better, cooler second movie that you wish you were watching instead of this one. But maybe it's just because we saw it on TV.
Yeah, and like the day before, 2 days before, but then we already knew that it existed. Man, I wonder how far they're going to go with this. That little baby talking is messed up stuff, man. Like that, I don't know, man. Like I'm thinking about my own kids, and it's like, man, if one of the kids started talking to us and had like demands, like complicated demands, you'd be like, no, you would go with this broker to that open house, for I must be born into a realm of water. It's like, whoa, kiddo, like, come on. And then they come out and they're still just pooping everywhere.
Diversify your investment portfolio. I need maximum resources.
Well, that's another way of getting high, is like having another person inside of you. It's messed up, man. It's an altered state of consciousness. Man. It's awful. Throwing up and everything.
We could keep going for hours on this one, but let's pull the sandworm into the station. Thanks very much, everyone who has listened to us talk about Dune Part 2, which we all enjoyed, in case that wasn't clear in the last hour. Thanks very much, Pete, and very much Mark for chatting with me about Dune. You know, it was it's good to be back to, you know, what used to be a staple of the Overthinking It podcast, where we would all go to like the number one movie in America that we before we would have done it last week, we would have done it the week it came out, but you know, it's still, it's for how arty it is. It's amazing to me how much money this film has made. I think it crossed 150, maybe nearly $160 million as of 2 weekends in release. So, you know, it's good to be back doing the old things. Haven't lost a step in our sand walk across this great desert of pop culture. All right, we'll be back next week with more Overthinking It podcast. Until then, you can visit us on the web at overthinkingit.com, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
probably
doesn't deserve.